music from Andrew Peterson, the song called Invisible God. Rock of Ages, that was Amy Grant along with Vince Gill, and Jim Cole sang for us Light of the World. Good morning to you. 10 minutes now past the hour on our Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning. And David, guess who's back? They'll never guess.
I'll never guess.
Well,
who?
You might. Who? Doug Greenwald. Who? Doug, the senior teaching fellow, executive director of Preserving Bible Times, a guy that's been absent with leave for 2 weeks. Out in Israel, he's back and fighting off a cold. But Doug, welcome home. Glad to have you back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back, and it was good to be gone.
Yeah. Well, we were dying of curiosity. I mean, it's just a shame that there's such a time difference, because going to Israel's got to be a really exciting thing, no matter how many times you've been there. And you were there, of course, with a new group of people, and you're teaching, leading a tour. It's not only, what is it, about 6,000 miles?
You know, it's almost 6,000 miles to the mile.
Okay, yeah. 6,000 miles, and it's like 2,000 years at the same time, at least at the areas of Israel where you travel and the things you're teaching and talking about. How was the trip? Tell us where it started, where it ended, and what happened in between.
Well, for starters, it was a 13-day trip, and we saw rain probably for part of 1 hour on one day. Other than that, the sun was out.
Good, wow. good.
I've never seen such lovely weather. And when we were in Jerusalem, it was, you know, mid-50s to mid-60s. And when we were in the Galilee, it was mid-70s. And when we were in the Dead Sea, it was in the low 80s. And they've had very heavy winter rains, but early winter rains. So the Sea of Galilee has never been higher in the last 30 years than it is right now. And because of the early rains and the early spring, the warm temperatures that have come, there was a lushness in the land that I've not ever seen. And so I think it was really a special time to be there. It's always a special time for different reasons, but weather-wise, rain-wise, water-wise, lushness-wise, it was about as beautiful as I've ever seen it.
Of course, we've talked many times about the difference in the geography north to south in Israel. It's almost like two different worlds. Down south, dry and barren and hot desert wilderness area. Up north, that's the agricultural area. They must be really happy with this weather and the rain in particular.
Well, they are, and with the Sea of Galilee that full, that bodes well for, since about one-third of Israel gets their water from the Sea of Galilee.
Ah, yeah.
And they have a contract, a commitment, it's not quite the right word, a treaty, I guess you'd call it, with Jordan that most people don't know about, but I think it's 50 million cubic meters of water a year have to go to Jordan no matter what. So when rainfalls are slight and you have that fixed capacity that you have to send to Jordan, Israel is always concerned, will there be enough left for us? And with this winter rain, that concern has been put aside for another year.
Is there still a fishing industry on Galilee?
There is. You do see some boats. It's not nearly as prolific and prodigious as perhaps it once was. What you do see now are a lot of fish farms around the Galilean area, and they're all producing St. Peter's fish for the tourist industry. Everybody has to have a lunch or a dinner with a St. Peter's fish.
What is a St. Peter's fish? I'm just a little ignorant on that count.
Remember in the gospel record, they needed a half shekel coin to pay a temple tax.
Oh, yeah.
And Jesus said, no problem, it'll show up. And then Simon found it in the mouth of a fish. Well, that's a form of tilapia. It's called the St. Peter's fish. Uh-huh. It's a fish that when danger presents, it sucks up its little baby minnows and holds them in its mouth until the danger has passed. And that's just, for a lot of people, that's an institutional thing you got to do. You got to have at least one St. Peter's fish meal when you go to Israel.
Well, I didn't know. That's the first I've heard of that. That's kind of an interesting story. Weather was good. What's the mood in Israel these days? A lot of tension? Is it relaxed and happy? I mean, they're living in the hub of a whole lot of nasty activity, kind of the eye of the storm, I think.
They are used to tension. They are used to threats. And when you're there, it's like there are no threats at all. I mean, I think they're so used to it that it doesn't concern them or disturb them like perhaps it would us. I felt absolutely peaceful, totally secure everywhere we went in Israel. I mean, you hardly even see a soldier. So the perception I think a lot of people have about going to Israel is really rather different when you get there. But what is an issue, a relatively new issue, is that Israel has the third hottest technology economy in the world, high tech, after China and the United States. Actually, the United States is first, China is second. And so the GNP is doing very well. And because of that, inflation is running 7, 8, 9% a year. And the purchase power of the middle class is just continuing to get eroded. And so there's more and more concern, more and more unhappiness that the government isn't doing something about this. Basically, if you're a 25-year-old young man and you've just gotten married and you want to buy a house, forget it. I mean, the pricing is just literally impossible. So there's some real social issues starting to brew in Israel because of the disparity. It's a little bit like Russia. There are about 20 tycoon families, you know, that sort of run the whole high-tech industry. And they got more wealth than you can shake a stick at. But there's a ton of people who are struggling in the middle. And so some of the same issues that we hear reverberating around the United States are even more exaggerated in Israel these days.
Are they talking deficits and that same kind of thing, overspending the budget? Is that an issue there?
You know, I didn't get into the budgetary issue. I suspect if it wasn't for support from like the United States for the military side of life, they certainly would be running deficits. But on the social side, I really don't know. And the other thing that's happening is a lot of resentment towards the ultra-Orthodox Jews building in Israel from the rest of the people who are not Orthodox. Orthodox makes up maybe 10% of the population. And because Israel has never had any one party who's ever been able to sustain or even have for one session of the Knesset a plurality, you've always got coalition governments. And so whether it's Likud or some of the other parties, you always have to court the minority parties, of which the ultra-Orthodox is one, to be in your coalition government so you can have a majority. And so the Orthodox has been able to extract tremendous concessions from the Israel government for their minority party support of maybe 8 or 10 people in the Knesset. And some of the things they've been able to get the government to agree to through the years is that their children don't have to be in the Israeli Armed Forces, the IDF. Furthermore, their children don't have to work. And the government will pay them a subsidy to learn Torah, study Torah, for their whole life.
My goodness. That's a surprise, because I understood that Israel is basically a secular government. I mean, we think of Jews and the ancient religion and the old worship practices. And, you know, that's 2,000 years ago. You mentioned that the Orthodox religion is now a small minority, 10%. Does that mean, would you call it a secular state then? Is religion an issue for most people?
I'd say the vast majority of people in Israel are cultural Jews. I mean, they honor the festivals more as a cultural heritage than they do a religious, you know, worship sense of celebration. But the ultra-Orthodox, who are 10% of the country, just have been able to wrangle tremendous concessions. And now that the middle class is being pinched and their cost of living is getting tighter and tighter, their purchasing power is going down and down, they're looking over at this 10% Orthodox community and saying, why are they getting a free ride from the government? Why are our taxes paying for that? And so in a recent election, there's been a party who's sort of stepped forward and said, enough is enough. We're not going to support this Orthodox community like that anymore. They need to get jobs. They need to contribute to the economy. They got a surprising response in the political vote. So that's an issue that's very much in flux right now. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Israeli Tea Party.
Well, sort of, yeah.
Sort of, yeah.
David, you mentioned you saw a couple of news articles on the wires this morning about Israel.
Well, you know, I was looking at one of them. One of them is a story out of the Washington Free Beacon, and it's a website in Washington, and predicting that unrest when Obama visits. And he said, particularly in the West Bank, he said, riots and protests are expected throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and have happened in the last couple of days. But that's a ways away from where you're talking about, where you were, Doug.
We never got close to the Gaza Strip, which is down in the southwest of Israel. Yeah.
Right. But did you get an idea for the feelings of Israel toward the U.S. these days? Same as it has been? Is there a change, a trend away? What?
I would suggest there's much more ambivalence towards Obama these days than there has been for past administrations in terms of solidarity, unquestioned support, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think we've improved our stock in the eyes of the average Israeli in recent years.
Hmm. Is there talk over there about either Iran or Syria, the trouble in Syria, or the rockets from Palestine?
Well, the rockets from Gaza, you know, that's been going on for 3 years. I mean, the people who live down in the south and near Beersheba get a rocket or two a day and have been for 3 years. So, you know, rockets are not new news, not an issue. It's just ho-hum, here comes a couple more. Literally, it's just part of daily living down south. So I don't think that's a big issue. In terms of Iran, no one, you know, really knows what to think about what's happened. But the average Israeli, I mean, not that I polled 1,000 of them, but sort of says, we're going to do what we have to do. We listened to a crazy man once before in the 40s, in the 30s, and we didn't take him seriously and paid an enormous price. We're not going to listen to crazy people anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, listen, no, John Delancey, I'm sorry, Dave, go ahead.
No, that's what I was just kind of reaffirming. And kind of that's what I hear. Well, I don't hear it, but I read it through. In between the lines, you know, and what Netanyahu says occasionally, that, you know, we don't really care about the rest of the world and what you guys think should be done. We will face down our immediate enemy and do whatever needs to be done. Yeah, we are the point of the spear. And if we have to go in and do whatever to stop crazy man again, then we'll do it.
Yeah, that's ideologically where they come from. The issue is, even with the best of resources and the best of United States' current bomb technology, can it now reach, you know, some of these nuclear installations buried in the sides of mountains? I mean, I don't know the answer to that, and I think that's part of the dilemma of if we give them more and more time to bury more and more of this stuff, we'll never be able to reach it. And so do we sort of have to do something in the near term here to buy more time, you know, to set them back maybe a couple, 3 years as opposed to forever? But, you know, I go back to the 90s when I used to spend a lot of time in Tel Aviv. And whenever we discussed politics, my host would say to me after considerable discussion, "Oh, Doug, you need to remember, whenever three get together, there's always four opinions." And now, it's hard to say with any one statement that you represent the majority of Israel on anything. I talked to some Jews, actually younger people, who think it would be good if Iran got a nuclear bomb. And maybe that's the detente that's needed to keep peace, much like when Russia, you know, finally got the bomb and the U.S. had the bomb and they had the Cold War, but they never went at each other in a nuclear sense. And so some Israelis aren't that concerned about. They actually think that could be a positive development. So it's real hard to make neat and tidy judgments, statements, and assessments about current events in Israel.
Well, of course, Doug, you were there as a leader of a tour. You had a group of people, and I presume you went to a number of the holy sites, took a look at what archaeology and its relation to Scripture, what happened there. Is that how your tours are conducted?
Well, you know, I don't know what the other trips do. We position ours as more of a study program than a tourist trip, a contextual immersion experience. We're doing an awful lot of teaching, not just on the site, but on the buses. as we go from site to site. I personally do not like people to be overwhelmed with a ton of facts unless we can organize the facts for them. And so I spent a lot of time in the very early portion of the trip setting what I call the motifs, the storylines, the umbrella themes that we're going to be dealing with as we go throughout our 2 weeks, so that they can take the various sites and fit them into these motifs and themes. So, for example, one of the themes we developed throughout that period is the clash of two cultures. There's observant Judaism, and it's a clash with the world of the Greco-Romans and hedonism. And so a lot of the sites are Greco-Roman hedonistic sites, like Caesarea Maritima, like Sepphoris, like Hippus, like Caesarea Philippi, like Scythopolis. And so it's nice to be able to tie those things together. Another theme I like to work on is the contrast of two kings, King Jesus and King Herod, because we go to a lot of King Herod sites. And it's nice to do the compare and contrast between this earthly king and this heavenly king as a counterpoint. So another theme that we work on is the conflicts of Jesus with the Sadducees, the temple elite, the Jerusalem Pharisees, and so forth. And a sub-theme, which I really like to develop, I don't know how many trips do, but I call it the Jewish nationalism motif. I really want people to get a feel for a glimpse into the soul of Judaism, particularly as we know Israel today. And so we'll go to some of the ancient sites like Masada, like Gamla, like the Arbel Cliffs, where there have been showdowns in the past over your faith versus other cultures and Romans. And it just, I think, really helps to give people a glimpse into the corporate soul. One of the things we do early one morning on the Sea of Galilee, which I don't think any trip does, we go over to a little innocuous cemetery where it's sort of the de facto Arlington Cemetery for the artistic types of Israel. And buried in that little cemetery is a woman named Rachel, who is the de facto poet laureate of Israel. And we read her poetries from the 1940-1950 period of time. Our Israeli guide plays the recorder, so he actually plays some songs of Rachel's poetry that's been set to music that are quite popular in Israel. And so we do these little different kind of things to give people for the contemporary feel, call it the soul of Israel today, which they really seem to appreciate. So I think that's one of the things that I like to do, because I like connecting the dots. I like umbrella themes. I like motifs and frameworks that tie things together. Because you can so easily get lost in a myriad of historical and archaeological facts when you go to 50 sites in Israel. And after a while, it's sort of overwhelming. So I like to help people keep it all straight and clear by making sure we're aware at 5,000 feet what's going on here as we move from site to site.
Then, of course, that's nothing more than context. That's what you're really talking about, is the whole setting in which something happens, so that the facts have meaning that way.
Yeah, and let me give you one example. Early the first day, we leave Tel Aviv and we go up the coast for maybe 20 miles to a place called Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea on the sea. It's on the coastal plain. It's on a beach. It's a lovely beach. And this is where, from say 22 BC to about 10 BC, Herod the Great built himself a destination city, you know, think Las Vegas, of 25,000 people, so that he would have something to allure people in the Eastern Mediterranean basin to come to his little piece of land here where he was king. And he was in a competition with Cleopatra in Egypt, who was building monumental things to lure people to Egypt. You know, it was a competitive kind of thing. And so he built this gorgeous city right on the waterfront there, on the beach, called Caesarea Maritima. And one of the things that you begin to get an appreciation of when you get to Israel and you go up and down the coast is there are no natural harbors. So Herod had to make himself a harbor. And he was the first one that brought in cement from the Bay of Naples. And what he began to do is to construct substantially large barges, 50 foot long, either 8 or 18 foot wide and 9 foot deep. And what they would do is they'd throw a layer of rocks in the barge, and then they'd lay a layer of concrete, and then they'd put in more rocks, and then they'd layer in some more concrete. You get the idea here. Mm-hmm. They're building cement rock cubes. I guess they're really rectangles, 50 foot by 18 foot by 9 foot. And then as it got within 12 inches of the waterline, he would tow it out to a certain place where he wanted to drop it, put in the final layers of rock and concrete, and this thing would sink. And he did that enough times that he literally built an artificial breakwater out to the Mediterranean with a north-facing entrance because of the prevailing southwesterly wave action. And he builds himself a harbor. First time cement had ever been used in the Middle East.
And it's still holding up.
Well, you can still see it, actually. It's a little bit, it's below water now, but if you get up high enough, you can see this dark profile of where many of those cement cubes are still down there on the floor of the Mediterranean. And we use this to set the contrast right on day one, this clash of two cultures, because you got to go back to 332 BC when Alexander the Great comes into this part of the world. He brings with him a Greek language and Greek philosophy and a Greek lifestyle, which is hedonism. And so, you know, after a while, it gets married with the Romans, and we call it the Greco-Roman worldview. And this city of Caesarea Maritima is a Greco-Roman city. It's just full of Gentiles and compromised Jews called Hellenistic Jews. And you can just see the clash in cultures. So after about 130 years of this Greek influence in the land, we're now about 200 BC, there begins to be a crisis in Judaism. Because Judaism is not a philosophical language, it's not a philosophical culture. Greek is heavy on philosophy, and the Greek philosophical view of life was overwhelming Judaism. The young men were leaving the observant Jewish faith in droves. Crisis in about 170 BC that caused the Pharisee sect to be created to call Jewish young men back to the covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so that's a backdrop you have to understand. It comes from the intertestamental period of time. So if you freeze that thought and then extrapolate it to the time of Jesus, when Greco-Roman world is embedded in this land, you go to a place like Caesarea Maritima, and it's hedonism unbounded. If it looks good, touch it. If it feels good, do it. If it tastes good, eat it. And one of the things you begin to appreciate is Rome's strategy for conquering all these diverse lands that its legions have conquered is entertainment. They keep people so busy being entertained that they don't have time to think about how bad Rome is running the place. They don't really have time to think any serious spiritual thoughts. And they're just encouraging hedonism. And so you've got spectacles, hippodromes, you've got spectacles in the theater. You've got gymnasiums, you've got baths, and all of this is creating a clash between the Greco-Roman world and the world of observant Judaism. Because in the world here, of the Greco-Roman world, there are idols, there are statues all over the place. Icons to Zeus, icons to Caesar, icons to Jupiter. I mean, you name it. It's a polytheistic world. And then you've got these Jewish boys who have been raised on no graven images. So you've got the clash between an iconic culture and an iconic culture. You've got this clash between entertainment and the world of worship. You've got this contrast between individualism, the world of the Romans and the Greeks, and the world of the community first, observant Judaism. You've got the world of ideas and concepts in contrast with the world of scrupulous behavior. You've got the contrast of the world of evil with the world of God. You've got the contrast of monotheism with the Jews with the polytheism of Rome. And this culture is going on all the time as a backstory in the Gospels. And it's a great place to set it on our very first day when we go to this Caesarea Philippi, or Caesarea Maritima place for me to start to develop these kinds of umbrella themes that we will then carry out through the rest of the week. So I hope that gives you one idea of how we're trying to make sense out of sites, how we're trying to knit sites together, how we're trying to tie sites to a greater storyline rather than just to say, here it is, this is how old it is, this is the building materials that built it, these are the number of people that live there, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. It's got to be unavoidable to make parallels between between current times and not just in this country, but I would think in most of Western Europe.
When you hear the Roman strategy for subjugation, entertainment, and how they carry that off, you are immediately taken into our world today. Hmm. It's an entertainment, whether it's ESPN or MTV or video games. I mean, the parallelisms are just stunning.
Yeah, and of course that's the reason for a lot of the animosity between Islam and the West is what our media portrays. You know, it's that lifestyle that they think we represent, that the media represents of us. It paints a different picture than we really are.
Yeah, and that raises a brand new thought. While I was over there with this time talking with some people, I realized we have to have a different kind of trip. We need to go to Italy from Rome south to Sorrento and put together a 10-day trip on the how Paul encounters the Roman world. I think our understanding of the Roman world is quite small, and boy, it's a backdrop for the Gospels. It's a backdrop to the epistles. But it's this whole issue of entertainment and the strategy, and particularly the media. For some friends I was talking to about working the details out for this trip said to me, do you know who the top 10 best-selling authors were at the time of Jesus in the Roman world? And I said, no, I don't. Do you know the top 10 plays that were playing in the Roman theaters all out through the Roman Empire? I said, no, I don't. I said, when you do, you will realize the decadent entertainment, the decadent culture, the decadent lifestyle that's being propagated here. And now you begin to understand what Paul is confronting and what he's dealing with and how he tries to manage the media of his day. So I'm really excited about this brand new embryonic trip we're putting together to study the Roman world of Paul for next year, because I think we need to catch up to these insights and understandings, because Paul was dealing in a world that was friendly towards Christianity. And if you look at the 20th century, by and large, evangelical Christianity has had the winds of culture blowing at their back. They were generally supportive. But boy, in the last 10 or 15 years, the winds have shifted, and now they're starting to vehemently blow in the face of Christians antagonistically. And Paul had to deal with that. He had to confront that. And I think we really need to go back through his writings, his epistles, to see with this Roman backdrop how he was then dealing with that, because we need to learn this lesson, because I don't think we figured it out yet. Anyway, that was just a segue into some other thoughts that happened on this trip that deal with this whole issue of media and entertainment.
Well, I'll tell you what, sign me up for that one. Well, sign me up for both of them. I want to go to both places. Oh, there's so much to learn, and it does sound like history is kind of repeating itself, kind of swinging through the same kind of confrontational ambience, historical ambience that prevailed back then. And by the way, John DeLancey said to pass along his greetings to your tour guide. I understand that you share him.
Yeah, his name is Shlomo Ben Asher.
Mm-hmm.
Guy. He's one of the few understated Jewish guides. He plays a recorder. He's an artist. He writes poetry. He sings. And he's just a wonderful resource for contemporary Israel life on our trips for the three of us teachers. So as our group said, they so appreciated the fact we had three teachers on our tour. It was, well, stereo was two. I don't know what you call them, three.
Yeah, surround sound, yeah.
Surround sound, bones around. But, you know, it's really helpful because any one person has a given perspective, and you really want to have multiple perspectives on the same thing when you go to Israel to do your best to get the most miles per gallon from what I call a trip that you spend money on, but an investment in your spiritual journey.
Well, we're glad to have you back and looking forward to Wednesdays. And, of course, those of us here in the north central Minnesota, eager to welcome you personally on the 5th and 6th of April with your Bible Alive seminar. So preparations are underway for that, and we can hardly wait.
Me either.
Well,
yeah, it's going to be a good time.
We're talking
just off the runway for that weekend.
I heard from my wife, this is also the same weekend that there's going to be a Republican state meeting, a state convention. And I'm not a delegate this year. I'm an alternate, so I'm not going to go. I mentioned that to my wife, who is a delegate, and she said, well, maybe I'll stay here and go to this with you. I think I'd like to meet Doug, too. So you're taking over from politics. Say.
Yeah, that's saying something with the David really? Allen Punt family. We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. There's a website you can go to learn more about his tours and about Doug and about his teaching and about the wealth of materials, resources they have there for your church and for your Bible studies and small groups. That's preservingbibletimes.org, the website. You can link to them from our website. You may be listening there right now at brokenroadradio.com. Just over on the right-hand side of the homepage there, you'll see the link to Preserving Bible Times. Doug, good to have you back, and we'll talk to you again a week from now, okay? Be blessed, and take care of that cold.
Next week, we'll do this, focus on the new insights I got on this particular trip, because you always get new insights, but the particular ones that struck me this time that I saw before.
We'll look forward to that, yeah. We'll talk
about it.
Doug Greenwald, Preserving Bible Times. Music from Phil Keaggy.